I'd like to call the Senate Special Committee on Natural Gas Development to order. It's now 15 minutes after the hour of 9 a.m. And it's we have Senator Kukish, Senator Stedman, Senator Wilkin, Senator Green, Senator Elton, Senator Hoffman, Senator Ben Stevens, myself, Senator Seekins, in attendance. And Senator Dyson, I don't think, will be with us today, nor Senator Bundy. Yesterday, as we were coming to a close, we were talking about the basin control issue. And we had our legislative consultants meet with us for a few moments. And one of the things that this committee has strived to do is, in an issue of discussion, to try to present all sides of the issue as clearly and succinctly as we possibly can. And with that in mind, I talked to some of the producers and asked if, in terms of basin control, they would be interested in also addressing the committee on the issues that we talked about yesterday. I also asked Mr. Leffler to see if he could arrange for someone on Tuesday, that when we come back from FERC, to be able to address the committee, and he said that he would pursue that for us. And for your information, we will reconvene at 1:30 on Monday, the 24th. That'll give everyone a chance. Some of our members are coming in on the morning plane, gives you a chance to get organized. But Tuesday we will hopefully have someone to be able to address us either here or online from FERC on that issue. So with that, who would like to be able to address us this morning from the producers on the basin control issue? Welcome back. And if you folks would be kind enough to introduce yourself once again to the members. We'll get another chair. We can find another chair. Just grab one from the side there somewhere. And we'll be eager to hear your comments this morning. So why don't we start on your right, my left, and for the record, introduce yourselves.
Chairman Seekins, for the record, my name is Wendy King with ConocoPhillips up here in Alaska.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Brad Keithley. I'm with the law firm of Jones Day, and I represent BP on these matters.
Brad, could we ask you to spell your name for the record?
Brad Keithley.
Keith?
Keithley, K-E-I-T-H-L-E-Y is the last name.
Keithley.
First name is Brad.
Okay. Okay, and?
For the record, my name is Patrick Coughlin. I'm a counsel for BP, and my last name is spelled C-O-U-G-H-L-I-N.
Thank you, Mr. Coughlin. Okay, who would like to begin? Mr. Coughlin.
I would just like to take a minute to introduce Mr. Keithley. Mr. Keithley is a partner with the law firm of Jones Day, which is a large international law firm. He has extensive experience in representing oil and gas companies both in the United States and internationally. In particular, for years, Mr. Keithley has been BP's counsel with respect to matters pending before FERC. He currently represents us there. He's also advising us on Order 2005 and the duties that it places on companies to separate functions, to provide training programs to its employees regarding the scope of that order, and to set up compliance programs, all of which we are already in the process at BP of implementing. So with that, I'd like to introduce Mr. Keithley.
Mr. Keithley, welcome to the Senate Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate your welcome. By way of background, just so you know where I'm coming from, Jones Day is an international law firm. We have 2,200 lawyers in 30 offices worldwide. We have approximately 100 lawyers focused on oil and gas, and utility matters worldwide. More than half of those lawyers are located, frankly, in international offices in London, Paris, and Singapore. And as a team, we have extensive experience in pipeline projects in the U.S., Asia-Pacific, Russia, and Africa. Personally, I have extensive experience with the issues involved in this project and the issues that the committee's been talking about the last few days. From 1984 to 1990, I was the senior vice president and general counsel of what was then the third largest gas company in the United States. That company owned both pipelines and production affiliates. And during that period, the FERC started issuing the orders that Mr. Leffler talked about extensively yesterday. And as general counsel, I was directly, I directly had to confront those issues at a time when the industry was in a considerable state of flux. Since that time, I have advised and represented in the U.S. and elsewhere on a long list of new and existing upstream and pipeline projects, and in the course of that have continued to advise companies on affiliate-related issues. I've worked with BP on this project and was asked by them to appear briefly this morning to discuss some of the affiliate issues. Let me say at the outset, Mr. Chairman, I was pleased yesterday to hear you announce that you're going to include FERC, Representative FERC, in these hearings. I believe that will help to bring a lot of clarity to these issues, to have the agency speak directly on these issues. In the meantime, however, we want to make certain that the record is complete on three issues that came up yesterday. The first is Mr. Shepler's concern that the FERC cannot deal with pipeline expansion issues that may arise after the open season as additional exploration occurs. The second is Mr. Shepler's concern that the FERC is a long way away and the proceedings there are very time-consuming. And the third is Mr. Harper's suggestion that various specific terms, such as a pipeline tariff, can be drafted at this point and should be drafted at this point. I believe all three of those points are wrong and want to briefly tell you why. First issue is that FERC already is positioned to deal with post-open season expansion issues. Mr. Shepler indicated the legislature needs to act and require provisions in the contract to ensure that after the open season that the pipeline does not discriminate against non-affiliates, and indicated that the FERC does not have the authority to deal with that. That's not accurate. The FERC's existing rules already deal with producer pipeline affiliate issues of the type raised here. In Order 2004, which Mr. Leffler discussed yesterday, which was issued in 2003, the FERC recognized that producer pipeline affiliate issues exist in the lower 48 pipelines. Indeed, in 2004, the FERC spent a long time discussing the potential for producer pipeline affiliate issues. FERC noted that as of 2003, 16 lower 48 pipelines were transporting gas for their production affiliates, and that those production affiliates held on average 37% of the affiliated pipeline's capacity, and noted that on six of the pipelines in the lower 48, producer affiliates held more than 60% of the firm transportation capacity. In other words, the FERC noted that there were already in the lower 48 producer pipeline affiliate problems. As a consequence, in its Order 2004, the FERC extended regulation that previously had only occasional application to production affiliates to comprehensive regulation of the producer pipeline affiliate relationship. And as part of that, the FERC has provided rules and remedies related specifically to expansions on affiliated pipelines after the initial open season. Specifically, in Order 2004, the Commission discussed how it expects pipelines affiliated with producers to deal with expansion issues. In a section of that order, the Commission required that a pipeline owner treat all transmission customers, both affiliated and non-affiliated, on a non-discriminatory basis. Order 2004A goes on to state that, quote, transmission providers must provide interconnection and expansion services on a non-discriminatory fashion to similarly situated non-affiliated requesters. That is, the FERC specifically has provided that with respect to a pipeline that has a producer affiliate, the pipeline must provide expansion services both to non-affiliates and affiliates on an equal basis. In Order 670, which Mr. Leffler discussed yesterday, the Commission has issued rules dealing with market manipulation. And those rules make it clear that it is unlawful for a pipeline or an affiliate to engage in, quote, any action for the purpose of impairing, obstructing, or defeating the honest functioning of the market. Certainly, the refusal to expand a pipeline in order to coerce other producers into selling their lease position or restricting their ability to market gas that they might develop would fall in that category and violate FERC's Order 670. and as a result of that, result in civil and criminal sanctions against the pipeline and the producer affiliate. It's BP's goal that we want to be in business, in the business of producing exploration gas and oil on the North Slope. We do not want to put others out of that business. We simply want to make sure that we can participate in that business, and the FERC orders compel us to act in a way that enables all of us to participate. Finally, under Section 105 of the Alaska Natural Gas Pipeline Act, FERC has the authority to require expansions. That is unprecedented authority in the industry and is in direct response to state and non-affiliated producer concerns expressed at the time that the ANGPA was passed. The second point that I want to address is Mr. Shepler's concern that the FERC is a long way away and that these issues would require extensive proceedings. That's not the case. The FERC is able to deal with any non-affiliated or affiliated or other concerns about violations on a real-time basis. In particular, the FERC has developed what they call an enforcement hotline to deal with potential violations. The hotline is staffed by the FERC's enforcement division. You're able to call it on a daily basis. It's up and running every business day. It's open 12 hours a day. And at the end of the phone are people employed by the FERC who are there to solve problems. According to the FERC, quote, the enforcement hotline has resolved hundreds of disputes informally and answered hundreds of public inquiries and has resolved a number of disputes specifically with respect to affiliate issues. So the FERC is there on a day-to-day basis. It's there on a real-time basis. What happens when you call the enforcement hotline and have a complaint is that the people on the hotline turn around and call the pipeline and ask the pipeline what the facts are. And the pipeline has to respond immediately to tell the hotline what the facts are. And the enforcement hotline, as the commission's noted, has resolved and does resolve on a continuing basis most of the complaints, a large part of the complaints that come up in connection with the operation of pipelines and producer-affiliate issues. In addition, the FERC has established audit teams that go out and conduct on-site reviews and audits of pipeline compliance with the Commission's orders, and that enables the FERC to get out in front of these compliance issues rather than wait until complaints come to them. And the FERC is very active in these compliance audits, has issued a number of orders as a result of the compliance audits requiring pipelines to take further actions in order to be in compliance with the Commission's regulations. It's a very real-time enforcement tool. I think there's one other enforcement tool here that needs to be brought to light, and in fact is very much on at least BP's mind, and that is the state's powers to act as a policeman in connection with these issues because of the state's position as an owner of the pipeline. As a pipeline owner, the state of Alaska is very well positioned to help resolve any issues which might arise between the pipeline and non-affiliates on a real-time basis. As an owner, the state will participate in the pipeline's internal processes. It's involved in the development of the compliance policies, and the state will have immediate access to information about potential non-compliance situations. If Anadarko has a concern, they can go to the FERC hotline. If Anadarko has a concern, however, they also can go to the state. And the state, as a pipeline owner, can investigate separately and will have immediate access to the information related to that complaint. The state is very well positioned to refer issues to the FERC for enforcement and obtain and provide information on a real-time basis if that becomes appropriate to resolve any issue. One of the reasons that formal complaints take a long time at the FERC is because discovery is a problem. The party making the complaint seeks information from the pipeline, and the pipeline takes a while in providing it. With the state as an owner, the state's going to be inside the fence and able to obtain that information directly and quickly and able to provide it to FERC in order to facilitate the FERC's response. So the state is positioned as a pipeline owner, is positioned to play the role of an additional internal policeman on the beat, if you will, in connection with these issues. Final point that I want to address is Mr. Harper's suggestion that we should be preparing a tariff now. A pipeline tariff is usually several hundred pages and provides the details of pipeline rates and terms and conditions of service and terms and conditions of operating the pipeline. In order to prepare the tariff, you need to know full knowledge about the costs involved in the pipeline, the operating parameters, the design, the pressures, several pipeline characteristics. It is unreasonable to believe that participants that the participants in the pipeline are in a position at this point to be able to establish those details and be able to write a tariff. We need costs, we need design criteria, we need operating conditions, we need pressures, we need offtake points, we need delivery points, we need quality specifications. All of that information is far down the road, and we're not in a position to write a tariff currently. Closing, I simply want to emphasize that BP already is hard at work in developing a plan to implement the FERC regulations and ensure that we comply with the non-discriminatory aspects of the FERC regulations and ensure that we comply with the Order 670 requirements of FERC that we not engage in market manipulation. We're already far down the road in having a plan for how we separate the pipeline function from the producer function. We're far down the road in how we ensure that we have non-disclosure of information from the pipeline side to the producer side. We're already far down the road in thinking about our internal chief compliance officer, which is required by the FERC regulations to ensure that we have an internal policeman monitoring our compliance with the regulations. We take the regulations and our duties to act in a non-discriminatory manner very seriously, and we can assure you that we will continue to do so. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Before we ask questions, the Chair would like to recognize and welcome that Senator Gary Stevens is with us and Representative Ralph Samuels. Questions for Mr. Keithley from members? Oh, and Senator Olson has joined us.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman.
Yes. Senator Green.
When you were talking about the state would be in a position to give the information to an inquiry, is the state at a greater obligation to provide information such as under FOIA with their participation as a partner in the pipeline, or do they then lose that obligation once they're in quote corporation?
Yeah. Senator Green, through the chairman, the exact requirements of what information the state could disclose publicly will be dealt with in the LLC agreement. However, in terms of operating the pipeline business, which would be dealing with FERC, the state would be in a position to share that information just as if as any other member of that LLC would be free to share that information with FERC, so it could use the information to address concerns with FERC.
I'm not talking about free to do it. I'm talking about being obligated to go beyond what another partner would have to go beyond.
Again, Senator Green, if the state thought that the LLC was in non-compliance with FERC regulations, it would have an obligation itself to go forward and report to FERC.
Senator Stevens.
Thank you. I'm sorry, I didn't hear your last name.
Keithley, K-E-I-T-H-L-E-Y.
Thank you, Mr. Keithley. Good morning. I'm curious to have your opinion. Obviously, you have a lot of experience in the pipeline business prior to your current role with Jones Day in regards to essentially a pre-publishing of a tariff rate. To your knowledge or your experience, have you ever seen a tariff published prior to sanction?
A tariff will be prepared in connection with the open season, Senator, to give a draft tariff, to give the parties an opportunity to prepare for the open season. I have never seen a tariff prepared in advance of that point.
So the tariff is prepared prior to open season?
To be available at the open season.
At the open season.
So that parties know what they're bidding on, so that they know the terms and conditions of service that will be applied to the pipeline, and they know what terms and conditions they're bidding on.
If I might, Mr. Chairman. So in your experience where you have multiple owner groups involved in a project of this magnitude, which I don't think there are very many of them, but is it unusual for the request to come for a tariff to be published from a non-owner group?
It's not unusual for non-owners to make that request because they want to start trying to affect the process early on. But it just can't be done. I mean, you don't have the information until you've studied the pipeline and know how the pipeline is going to operate and have a good feel for the cost of the pipeline. You just can't bring that information together.
So this is nothing new in terms of non-owner participants requesting information on a project prior to the formation of the project. And so, again, it's nothing new that parties trying to protect their interests that aren't willing to put the money up for construction want to have equal footing with those that are putting the money up for construction.
To be very honest, I have seen nothing new in this project. I have seen the type of behaviors that you ordinarily expect with respect to a large project. And non-affiliates want, or non-participants sometimes want more information that can be given.
And so from an independent legal perspective, you obviously are representing an interested party in this project, but you probably represented non-affiliates at some point in your career.
Yes.
I'm making an assumption that you think it's an unreasonable request to ask for information that's not yet compiled at this point in the process.
It may not be unreasonable to request it. It's sort of unreasonable to expect that they will give it to you.
Maybe I should rephrase that. Maybe it's unreasonable to expect information that's not yet available, even to the owner affiliates.
I think that's fair, Senator. There's a lot of posturing that goes on during these projects, and you ask for things sometimes that you don't expect to have an answer to, but you try to press as hard as you can.
I appreciate that opinion.
We don't have any posturing around here.
No, we don't have any posturing. But again, I think it's interesting to hear a perspective that this is nothing new in terms of trying to garner an advantage at some point, or perceived advantage, or give another group a disadvantage in the negotiation when the information requested is not even available. So, thank you. I appreciate your comments.
Other questions? Seeing none, Ms. King, welcome back.
Thank you. Again, for the record, my name is Wendy King with ConocoPhillips. I wanted to offer a few comments as well in response to some of the points that were made yesterday. And first one I wanted to emphasize is that I actually see this project as a basin opening project. It's going to create significant new opportunities for oil and gas exploration in the state. I think I've mentioned to you before, but when you're exploring for gas, you sometimes find oil. In fact, in many of the reservoirs in the world, gas and oil exist in the reservoirs together. So I actually see that the exploration potential that will be opened up by this project is a significant aspect to this project. I would also offer, as my colleague has said here, that it is safe to assume that FERC's going to scrutinize this project to ensure that it is an open access project. It's estimated to be between 6 to 10% of the nation's domestic supply, and that's a significant portion from one particular project. I'd really like to emphasize that point, that opening the basin is what this project is about. One thing that was discussed at length yesterday was the exploration volumes that are out there. In the base design in the 2001-2002 study, it was estimated that we need approximately 50 TCF of gas to fill the pipe for the time frame of approximately, I think it was 30 years, maybe 35 years. Of that 50 TCF, only 35 TCF is publicly known resource today, which indicates already that the pipeline was anticipating that exploration volumes were going to be needed to fill the pipe over the project scope. What we also don't know is what the actual open season will result in. We don't know who's going to show up and bid for capacity. It may be more than that. So it may need more than the 15 TCF to fill the base design as a result of that open season. But what we do know is that we have been planning on exploration potential to fill the pipeline. With respect to the expansion potential, in the 2001-2002 study, we were looking at a roughly about a 4.5, approximately 4.5 B a day pipeline, 4.5 BCF a day pipeline. In that study, from infill compression, just by, you've got compressor stations approximately 100 to 150, maybe 200 miles apart, depending upon where you are in the pipeline, just from infilling the compressions, so putting a new compressor station between the two old compressions, that you could increase the deliverability in the pipeline from roughly 4.5 up to 5.6 BCF a day. And so you would get an incremental B from that. But one thing that, you're going to need significant gas volumes to fill that additional B a day. So not only do you need exploration to fill the base design, if you do pursue an expansion, you're going to need significant volumes to fill that expansion as well. The one thing about expansions, though, that I think I've mentioned in previous testimony is that there's no one-size-fits-all as to how the expansions might progress. And I specifically remember getting a question in one of the hearings about, could you expand the pipeline from the North Slope to Fairbanks, just that section of the pipe? I've also had somebody ask me, could you expand the pipeline from just Fairbanks south? What if there's some big exploration potential found in, is it Mento Flats, and could you expand the pipeline south from there? I've also had equivalent questions on the Canadian side. What if you found a bunch of gas in the Yukon? Could you expand the pipeline from the Yukon south? So there's a whole different host of scenarios that could evolve about different expansions over a different time frame. You might have one expansion occur, and then 5 years later, somebody might ask for an expansion of the entire system. And so to develop a one-size-fits-all, this has to be the solution for how an expansion will be treated now, doesn't fully anticipate all the different outcomes that could potentially occur over a project of this size and scope and magnitude. Another point that was referenced yesterday was respect to the sponsor group's current petition with FERC with respect to Order 2005 and Order 2005A. And I just wanted to emphasize one point out of that. This is quoting directly from that petition. And by the way, I believe that petition was made public in early June this year. The FERC established, this is reading directly from the petition, thus FERC established numerous unprecedented procedures, conditions, and presumptions applicable to the award of capacity on and rates for Alaska natural gas transportation projects in order to promote competition in the exploration, development, and production of Alaska natural gas. These extensive requirements are not challenged here. This petition challenges the Commission's assertion of authority in sections 157 and 157.36 and 157.37 to mandate, long after the open season has ended, increased capacity for an Alaska gas pipeline project or expansion, and to dictate the amount of unsubscribed capacity and unused expandability that an initial project must build in. We clearly are limiting the scope of what this particular petition is about. It is not an open-ended petition. One of the key components of the Alaska Natural Gas Pipeline Act that we were supporting was that we need the streamlining of the permitting process. I mean, delays in the project are going to result in increased cost. And so one of the very things we were trying to strive for was getting a streamlined process. And so we're continuing to try to advance this petition on that sole issue. Another point that was made yesterday was with respect to producer-owned pipelines. And it is my understanding that post-636, there have been a number of producer-owned pipelines. Pipelines like Maritimes and Northeast, Destin, Garden Banks, Nautilus, Alliance, even Mackenzie Gas, and now, as I mentioned before, the Rockies Express Pipeline. For those pipelines that actually would have a portion of that pipeline in the U.S., all of those pipelines, to my understanding, are subject to Order 2004 and the FERC affiliate rules. Some of those pipelines have producer affiliates. Some have marketing affiliates. In fact, in some of those pipelines, you've got affiliates that have both producer and marketing affiliates involved. And all of those pipelines, to my knowledge, are operating under the existing Order 2004 FERC affiliate rules. I'd also highlight that these pipelines, some of these have changed ownership over time. Alliance is an example, I believe, where a pipeline was originally a producer-owned pipeline, but it's my understanding now that it's predominantly owned by a different set of companies. And so even for the state, BP, ConocoPhillips, ExxonMobil, and the state, as owners in the pipeline, will be able to make commercial decisions over the course of time about, do I want to maintain my ownership interest at my current level? Do I want to increase it? Do I want to lower it? And that's a commercial decision for each of the pipeline owners in the pipeline to pursue or make choices around. I would offer that I think I've testified before why ConocoPhillips believes it's important to align our ownership in the pipe with the firm shipping commitments and the expected gas volumes. I think we've talked about passing the costs to get passed on to the holders of the firm shipping commitment. And once again, to highlight, firm shipping commitments are telling the pipeline, I will pay you day in, day out, to ship on this pipeline regardless if I move gas or not. And that financially underpins the project. And that's where we see it's important for us in these basin opening projects, where it's such a significant cost to stand behind that firm shipping commitment, to take an ownership position. We believe that we bring strong skills both to the project management and the execution of these types of projects. And so we do try to align in these basin opening projects with this ownership, firm shipping commitment, and our ownership in the gas. Just to close, I just emphasize again that one of the most exciting aspects of this project is that it does create exploration potential. It opens up a new basin and opens it up in a way, but through the exploration of gas, that you might also find additional oil volumes. With that, I'll close today and be happy to answer any questions.
Questions? Senator Steadman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There's been quite a bit of discussion on the potential size of the pipe and volumes and the estimated reserves and the reserves with more confidence of the 35 trillion BCF, but in the industry needing and the state needing about 50, but there has been some other discussion about a potential of 100 to 200 within the basin area. So how much risk exposure are we actually facing trying to get from 35 to 50? When the estimates appear to be 100, potentially to 200, with a vast area unexplored?
Senator Steadman, through the chair, you are correct. I have seen a number of public sources of data from USGS, Minerals Management Service, that have indicated that there's exploration potential between the North Slope and the Chukchi Sea that are in the orders of magnitude of 50 to 100, maybe even higher to 200 TCF, depending upon which report you're reading. I'm sure the exploration potential is a function of, can you find the gas? Can you find it in commercial quantities? How big will the pockets of the gas be? And can it be developed in a timely fashion to get it into the market? But yes, you are correct. There are a number of studies out there that would indicate there's significant exploration potential to be found on the North Slope. But that's why we've factored into our design that we are going to need some additional volumes. And in fact, I believe that the state's estimate was for the 70 TCF on the upstream model contract, that the condition of that was, I think, around 4.5 expanding to 5.6 B a day over the course of the pipeline, that would be approximately 70 TCF that you would need to fill that expanded volume over a course of 30 years, I believe it was, maybe 35 years.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Ms. Senator Steadman. Any other questions for Ms. King? Seeing none, Mr. Coughlin.
Who was it?
Mr. Scheffler.
Oh, Mr. Scheffler? Or
Leffler? Leffler, sorry.
Okay. Sorry. Mr. Leffler, let's. Ms. Coughlin, you wanted to address it. Just stay there.
No, I had no further comments.
No further comments?
Thanks.
Okay, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to. I don't want to step on anybody here.
thank you. Very briefly. Senator Green, you asked a couple questions that related to information, Public Records Act, things like that, and 2 points. One, we're trying to strike a balance in the LLC between protecting confidential information and yet recognizing that the public has an interest in this project. And so there, my recollection is there's not a general exemption from the Public Records Act, but there is protection of confidential information. I believe there is an exemption in a so-called PIPECO from the public meetings part of state law. The other point, which is bears emphasis, is that the state has said there is value to a seat at the table in watching what goes on, being able to launch inquiries within the LLC about what goes on, and we appreciate the recognition by BP that there is that value and the state would be able to use that information, or in some circumstances have a duty to use that information to raise issues at the FERC. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Yes.
So, Bill McMahon with ExxonMobil. Apologize for being late, Mr. Chairman.
Hey.
I guess a couple of thoughts I want to add to this discussion is that, there's a concern about what will FERC do in the future in the area of protecting the pipeline. And I guess one observation I have is that the administration and the legislature, independent producers, have all been very successful in getting their issues before FERC and having their issues reflected in the rulemaking to date. And as far as expanding the pipeline and that being an issue, for this pipeline, it's unique in that it's going to have three ways to be expanded. We have the traditional voluntary expansion, which is just the normal business dealings that a pipeline would go through to expand its asset to attract more customers to make more money, and that's something that's driven by the business parameters. But we do have the FERC mandated expansion that's in FERC Order 2004, and we do have the state initiated expansion that is in the fiscal contract. And so that's three solid ways for a pipeline to be expanded if someone comes in after the open season and has additional gas that they want to move on the line. Also, someone in that situation would have three additional ways to be able to move gas on the line outside an open season. If there's excess capacity on the line, existing shippers could release capacity that could be picked up for moving new gas. If someone approaches a pipeline about an expansion and there is excess capacity, they can have something called a reverse auction, where people who have capacity can give it back to the pipeline and then it can be given to a new shipper. The FERC doesn't want money to be spent if it's a waste if there's capacity available. And then, of course, there's business deals that could be made where gas could be sold to someone who does have capacity. So for the Alaska Gas Pipeline, there are many avenues on which to get gas on the line if you had not participated in the open season.
Okay. Questions? Senator Stevens.
Actually, I have two questions, maybe for Mr. Clark and Mr. Loeffler, but not specifically for this.
Okay. Mr. Loeffler.
And maybe
and Mr. Clark.
Yeah. Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning.
I wonder maybe if we could have a brief discussion on what would initiate the desire for an expansion, and what the state's interests would also be incorporated in that expansion, i.e. Let's make the assumption that open season has occurred and sanction is taking place and there's been a full subscription of capacity, and at some point in the future a new large field has been discovered by a non-existing shipper. And so I maybe Mr. Clark, you could walk us through what the state's interest would be in that new discovery and why the state, that's my assumption, the state would also want to be encourage expansion in order to get that gas to market.
Well, that's right.
And if I could ask you to introduce yourself for the
Excuse
record,
me,
Mr. Clark.
Jim Clark.
In other words, what alignment would we have as the state and a shareholder and a royalty owner and the severance that would take place on that in a new discovery and our desire as well as benefits of getting that new gas to market?
As Senator Stevens, I think that Mr. McMahon just referred to what our interest has been as reflected in what we have done before FERC up to this point, both in the legislation that passed Congress and in the FERC open season regs. We have been extremely aggressive in attempting to get maximum leverage to expand the fields and get all of the gas, state gas, to market. And we will continue to be aggressive in that way because we took an ownership interest in the gas, among other things, to be able to assure our all potential producers in Alaska that we can get that gas to market. We're currently developing policies not only for in-state use, but how we might better be sure that the gas found in Alaska gets to market. Why? Because it gives us our added royalty shares, our tax gas shares, and our intent as administration is to increase activity on the North Slope as much as possible so that we are a thriving regime going forward. Might break that down into a couple of pieces to go from the general to the more specific, just in terms of some of the things that we're looking at, which will be more reflected probably in the fiscal interest finding than in the contract. Let me just take the in-state use piece. We took our gas in kind. We have a mileage-sensitive rate, and we have four offtake points. Well, one of the things that we're going to have to do in order to assure that there's use in state before that open season is to find means of assisting potential buyers in being prepared for that initial open season. That's one of the things that we're going to be spending a lot of time making sure happens. With respect to new fields, we're hoping that Anadarko will have success in the foothills, that other producers will come to Alaska specifically to buy our leases and explore. We got to make sure that that gas gets to market. So I can just tell you that as we have looked at the LLC and the contract itself, it has been to be aggressive in making sure that we are able to move our gas to market. Bob, you might follow up behind it.
Let me add a sort of very narrow but precise definition. The state would have a financial interest in more volumes getting to market. It would get more gas equals more cash. Expansion equals more investment in the pipeline. State gets a greater return because there's more rate base from which the return is generated. So the state has very strong financial interests in expansion. It gets more with an expanded pipeline. There's more gas available to serve in-state needs, more exploration results. They're all pluses in terms of expansion.
Go ahead, Senator Stevens.
Well, I appreciate that, that you know, in the attempts to highlight the fact that, and if I'm understanding the responses correctly and understanding the the criteria laid out in 2005, as well as in the legislation in 2004, that in the way that the contract has been crafted actually aligns the state with independence for the development of future expansion, and I find it sort of interesting that we've had this hearing, the establishment of this committee now for over a month, and we continue to hear the concerns about independent expansion, and yet we have not had one independent come before this committee and express concerns to us on the contract. And I hope that, and I know you mentioned it yesterday, the only independent concern we've heard is from the legislative budget and audit consultants have expressed concern, and rightly so, on future access to the pipeline. But we haven't heard concerns from those who are potential yet, and I hope we do. I hope we get that when we come back, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Thank you. And I do believe that the consultants, Senator Wilkin, do you have a question?
Yeah, I do, but go ahead.
The consultants that we hire are there to try to advise us for the best interest of the people of the state of Alaska, and I believe, Mr. Clark, you understand from the amount of time that we've put into this issue on making sure that we don't end up with a situation where independent non-owner groups of the pipeline explorers can be able to get their gas to market, and it is a concern that we have, and I'm sure it is that you do too. So any potential contract that comes in, this will be, I'm sure, a very highly debated and scrutinized issue. We want to make sure that there is the opportunity for people within the boundaries of what FERC intends and what you've heard from us, that they be able to get that gas to market and not be precluded from being able to do so through some kind of manipulation, which $1 million a day probably would be a significant penalty.
Mr. Chairman, if I just might comment on your remarks, we fully subscribe to what you just said and the in terms of what our policies are. You recall yesterday there was a comment made by one of the gentlemen saying that the contract was not access friendly. I asked that we get specific information in terms of where not, and we will look at that as any thoughts advanced and that are specific to that about what we might do, and we'll be looking ourselves without any additional prodding from any consultants about how we might be able to improve upon it. We think we have a in the combination of the contract and the LLC, which unfortunately hasn't surfaced yet, you haven't seen it, but the combination of those two, we think we have a very, very strong set of policies that will ensure independent access. We have every reason. Remember, portion of those independents gas, it belongs to the people of the state of Alaska, and it's our job to maximize the monetization of that gas, development of that gas for everybody. So I think that in our past actions before FERC, we've demonstrated that that's where we are. We certainly have in the negotiations and the items that are in the contract, the LLC, and we will look for additional ways to improve upon those policies.
Senator Wilkin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question revolves around incremental versus rolled-in pricing. First, a couple of things. I understand that the conceptual line that we're speaking of allows about a 25% increase in expansion, cheap expansion, compressor expansion. When you get to the 26th percent, it becomes very expensive. I understand also that we can't tell FERC what to do, but we can certainly suggest or express a preference. So my question is, Mr. Clark, is there in the contract, or should there be in the contract or somewhere, a formal expression on behalf of the state of Alaska that expansion be limited to rolled-in pricing and not incremental pricing for the life of the contract?
We have Mr. Leffler deal with that. As you know, with the way it's set up right now, is that there's the presumption for rolled-in pricing in the regs, and the question is, when does rolled-in pricing become subsidization, which I think depends highly on the facts and circumstances of a particular expansion. But Mr. Leffler knows much more about this than I do.
Mr. Leffler.
Thank you. Bob Leffler again. The state position publicly in the FERC comment process and elsewhere has always been in favor of rolled in within limits. And I think FERC came out at a wise place until you get to specific facts and circumstances. At the extreme, some parties have suggested the state should be willing to, state only, should be willing to pay for an uneconomic expansion. And I think we want to avoid that result. But and there are sensible expansions and others that aren't. And we've struggled with trying to put some sideboards on what would be a sensible expensive expansion. And it's so fact specific that I think for you got to do what FERC did. Say there's a presumption and you'll deal with it when you get the facts and circumstances. I don't think we'd have any problem with, as a recital or something, this saying that the state favors the FERC policy in that regard. Whether you get agreement among all the other parties that they favor the FERC policy or not is a separate question. But you asked about an expression of state policy.
And just to add one thing, I believe I'm right, and Bob, correct me if I'm wrong, that the way this works is that if there is an expansion, a party coming on, the opponents would have to prove that it's a subsidy in order for there not to be rolled in pricing. And so that would be their burden before FERC. So obviously, rolled-in pricing makes expansions easier. We are for expansion. We have retained the right under the contract to be able to argue to FERC as the state, and took on in Article 8.7, which we're working with some folks who believe it could be tuned up and made better. But the position we took there was that we would have a state-sponsored expansion in order to, again, assure that we could meet our goals of assuring expansion. So that's what we were trying to do with that, and be able to have it subject to dispute resolution provisions of the contract rather than simply the mechanisms of FERC, so that we would be able to raise issues like that as a contractual, not a regulatory matter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Not only a regulatory matter.
Thank you. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to get a little bit off the topic at this point, and I apologize to the committee for that, but and the administration has said to keep the eye on the ball, which has been the gas line, and I've been trying to do that. But last night, Mr. Clark, the governor, in the special session in selling this package to get the project built, made a couple of comments that were a little bit disturbing to me. And I know that the administration has been supportive of rural Alaska and keenly aware of the energy needs out there. But in his presentation, in saying that he's going to share the energy in the future, and a lot of this has nothing to do with the line, but what will happen once the line is built, and we have the four takeoff points. But one was that sharing the energy costs with Alaskans that pay property tax. There are many people that have the highest energy needs that don't pay property tax, and that bothered me, you know. So I feel that is an issue that will be discussed and debated at a future time. You know, I felt that that wasn't a selling point to me. And the other one was that there was a lot of mention about getting the use of the in-state gas to the Valley, Kenai, Anchorage, Fairbanks, the major metropolitan areas, and no mention of how the rest of Alaska is going to benefit. And there's been some discussion, but in selling this to rural legislators, and so that we can continue to keep our eye on the ball, when the governor made his presentation, I thought that was a major shortcoming. And I know that this is completely off the subject, and I wouldn't have bring it up other than that the governor brought that up. I don't know if it was an oversight or what on his part, but I just wanted to make that statement.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hoffman, I think I can, let me just deal with the last one first. In the speech included a reference to using the takeoff point north of the Yukon to to look into the potential of stripping butane and propane and using the AYK river system to move bottled propane and butane to the villages. So that was in the speech, and it's something that we're actively looking to do as a means of trying to deal with reducing energy costs in rural Alaska. As you know, Nels Anderson chairs the Rural Energy Action Committee, which is specifically charged with looking into how we might do that. There was some previous work done in 2002, which we're building on, and that was what the governor was referring to in his speech yesterday. So we see that as a potential way to make this work. Now, as we've mentioned, the producers under the contract are required to give us a report in advance of the open season, which would show us the potential, their idea of potential for in-state uses of the gas, how we might use that, along with putting together a petrochemical industry and how we might do what we were just talking about. So the fact is, maybe I could show you after this is over where in the speech the governor said that, but he did refer to it yesterday. We're acutely aware of it, and I apologize if we didn't emphasize it enough. With respect to the relief for property owners, you're quite right. There was a reference in there about what the governor's vision about what might be done with some of the PPT funds going forward. But I think the governor's view was that was balanced with what's been a longstanding intent of his, first announced, I think, at the AFN convention 3 years ago, to fully endow the PCE fund, which is something he feels that we can hopefully get out of this session of the legislature. So those are two things that he saw as kind of a balance, reference to the impacts in rural Alaska and some reference to the impacts of property tax owners around the state. And so that was, I think, what he was trying to achieve. And more could be done in those areas, I think more will be done going forward.
And I'm sure we'll look forward to that discussion in the future. Other questions? Senator Elton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is kind of a function question and may end up being a learning experience for me. But previously we heard Ms. King talk about potential expansion downstream, whether in the Yukon or elsewhere. I'm assuming
you,
that if
can you get a little closer to the mic, Kim?
I'm assuming if there is expansion downstream, whether the Yukon or further downstream, that is going to limit the kind of expansion that can happen further upstream, because you can only expand so much. I mean, you're going to hit a point at which the new gas coming in the Yukon, for example, would preclude addition of new gas upstream, whether it's from Minto Flats or the North Slope Basin. And I'm wondering what the state's control is of expansion in Canada, where you've got the NEB. I mean, is there anything in the contract? Can there be anything in the contract that would preclude the kind of expansion downstream that would prevent expansion upstream?
I'm not an engineer, and maybe we should ask Ms. King to address this. But there can be all sorts of expansions. You can have one. Doesn't necessarily preclude another. It's more of an engineering question. So you could expand downstream, then find more gas upstream, do an expansion upstream. That's my sort of quasi-engineering understanding. And it's hard to envision all the scenarios that would arise over the life of this project. But the state also would be a participant in the legal vehicle for the Canadian side, and would have similar rights, the same rights as it does on the Alaska side, to talk about those issues and to participate in the planning. And I think we should ask Ms. King if she,
Ms. King,
as an engineer, to contribute to this.
Sorry. Chairman Seekins, for the record, I'm Wendy King again with ConocoPhillips. Senator Elton. First, I should emphasize my engineering background is actually in reservoir engineering, so my depth on pipeline engineering is pretty limited, and so I don't want to overplay my engineering skills from years gone past.
It's better than mine.
But from what I understand is that there are multiple options for expansion opportunities out there. If you can infill the compression once, you can probably infill the compression again. But how you would treat each one of those would be different depending upon where you've been in the design. And that was my point, is to say that because you've got maybe a pipeline at some point that's been expanded for, say, 400 million a day up at this point, and then later on at this point you've had a 500 million a day, when somebody comes along and says, can you expand the whole system to a B a day again, you're going to have to look at that and say, can you do that through infill compression? Do you have to move to where you have to add some additional pipe in sections of it? Not necessarily loop the entire system, but maybe potentially put some additional pipe in certain sections. And so all those are going to be handled on a specific case-by-case basis as you advance the engineering design in the project. I do know you're going to need to look at the J-curves. Specifically, there's a technique in pipeline design at looking at J-curves, and if the committee would like to follow up further on that. We've definitely got pipeline engineering experts that could definitely address that in a bit more detail, either through written follow-up, or we could get some people available if that would be.
Senator Elton?
Oh, sorry.
Well, I, Mr. Chair, I do think it would be helpful to follow up. I would hate to see us get in, and I don't know that it would even occur. I would hate to see us get into a position in which the pipeline has been fully expanded downstream, which would preclude addition of new gas from either the North Slope Basin or points in between.
I hope we get there and have to build another one.
Well, I mean, that would be good, but I would expect that somebody that's not an owner would have, you know, some issues with the fact that if we continually expand downstream and add new gas in down there, that would preclude additional gas from further north. That could be a problem.
Let me add one.
Mr. Leffler, go ahead.
One fact, then I'll defer to Ms. King to tell us all what a J-curve is. One of the tricky issues on expansion is exactly what you raise, even in state. If you expand at one point to take care of one field, you don't want to foreclose a field coming in a different geography. So that's why it's hard to have a sort of formulaic approach, as some have urged. You've got to, in all expansion planning, you have to look at what's optimal for what you know about, and what's optimal and what's coming down the pike later. And there are trade-offs there.
Ms. King.
Chairman Seekins, again, I would add one point. I'm going to let Mr. Griffin handle the issue with respect to J-curves. But one point, it hit me yesterday when the conversation was occurring. Fields decline. I mean, I think that there's this potential perception that when a field is nominated into the pipeline project, that it'll be this boxcar, that it'll produce 500 million a day and then all of a sudden drop to zero, and it'll fill a set amount of capacity. In reality, in my experience working in the Southern Gas Basin and in other places, what you've got is usually some period where you've tried to optimize your design, where you plateau for a period of time in a field, and then your reservoir pressure starts to decline to where you start to decline out. So an initial set of circumstances, the field size, where that optimum design was for both the upstream development as well as where it would fit into the economics of an expansion, would be that there's clearly going to be a point, even when you've had an expansion, where that field or that sequence of fields that prompted that expansion will decline out, creating new capacity. And that's where my colleague, Mr. McMahon, highlighted, before you'd ever go to an expansion, the FERC would require to say you need to do a reverse auction. Does anybody have any capacity through the natural decline that occurs in these reservoirs? Is there any capacity that's become available? They don't want to encourage waste. And so I see a kind of a natural sequence of where new fields, as they're coming on stream and you do an expansion part of it, there's going to be a decline that occurs on the course of those fields. And then therefore, then before a new expansion would be progressed, there'd be an opportunity through that reverse auction process for anybody to be able to get access to that capacity again. And so you kind of look at that whole life cycle of some plateau period through some decline period, new fields coming on stream. The other factor that I wanted to mention in light of yesterday's too is that the cycle time from exploration, when you find a discovery, you've then got to appraise it to find out how big it is. You usually want to test it to find out how is it going to produce, how is the dynamic reservoir going to operate. Then you actually need to develop the field. And that cycle time is not a very quick cycle time, particularly when you're limited in some of your abilities in some of these seasons to be able to progress some of those activities. So you've got that race of trying to get through the full cycle time from first discovery all the way through to be able to deliver that. And you've got the competing factor that some of the initial resources will be declining. And so looking at that whole sequence of different fields as they come in over time would be a pretty complicated effort in being able to look at all different kinds of scenarios coming in. With that, I'd actually turn to Ken to help me out a little bit more on the details of J-curves.
Okay. Well, without getting into too detailed a discussion, Ken,
I'll do that. Yeah.
If you'll introduce yourself to the record.
My name is Ken Griffin, Deputy Commissioner in DNR. And I'll just mention briefly what a J-curve is. I think I kind of missed the context of how that came up here. But a J-curve refers to the efficiency of a compressor or of a pipeline system, the energy efficiency with which it transports gas through the compression process. and the equipment has a range at which it is most efficient. And then as you drop below that range or above that range, the efficiency declines increasingly fast. And generally when a pipeline is designed, it is designed such that it is in that highest efficiency range. And I would presume in our case, we would design it such that you would be able to ramp up the equipment to some degree and stay within that high efficiency range. And then as you move beyond that, the efficiencies decline and you want to add compressors or add piping or that sort of thing. The reason I came up is, you know, we talk about, we have all these different scenarios that may occur. We may add pipe, or we may want to add capacity upstream, we may want to add it downstream, we may want to add it somewhere in the middle. And when we think of expanding pipe, we think of, well, we're going to go from 4.3 or 5 to 5.7 maybe. Well, the whole pipe doesn't expand that way. The pipes, the terrain, temperatures, and other things all affect pipeline capacity. So when the producers talk about a 4.3B line expandable to 5.7, they're talking about the capacity at the bottleneck, which is probably in the Brooks Range because of the terrain up there. But other parts of the pipe are going to have different capacities. So even if we were going to put a new expansion on the slope from top to bottom, how we would add that 1B or half a B or whatever probably will change in different parts of the system. We may need to loop in one area, whereas in another area all we need to do is add a few compressors. And in another area we may not have to do anything. So it's a complicated problem in any situation. And we've got FERC, as well as the interests of the state and the producers looking, the pipeline owners, looking at the long term as well as the immediate aspects of this.
Okay. Before we, I think we exhausted our discussion today on the expansion and what we call it, the potential basin control issue. What we want to do is we're going to take a short recess here in a moment, but we are, Mr. Harper is going to get us, I understand, a written summary of his comments and observations, which we'll look forward to. And as I understand the action from LBNA last night, as we need consultants to work with the committee, and Senator Stevens, Senator Wilkin were there, requests coming through the chairman of this committee, we'll have consultants available to work with us as well. And we are going to be looking at several different topics for additional work with the consultants. The next, we also have the authority to go ahead with the analysis from Econ 1 of the Port Authority plan, and we're going to try to get that as expeditiously as we possibly can. We want to give the Port Authority the opportunity to present their plan and get this independent analysis working with the people from the Port Authority so that we can, in the end, we don't end up with a situation where we say, well, yeah, but this report was done without talking with us, looking at the specifics, et cetera, so that we can give that a fair hearing, and that will be coming up in this committee. So if we do have things that we need to address with our consultants, if the members would work with me, I have that authority to request it as chairman of this committee. So with that, let's take a five-minute recess and try. Oh, Ken, go ahead.
Can I make just go back to Senator Hoffman's issue that he brought up a minute ago?
Okay.
The governor has made it very clear to me that he has expectations that I and DNR will look at how the rural energy issue is going to be addressed related to this project, and he's been very clear to me about that.
And I know all of us took an oath of office, and we are looking for the maximum benefit of our resources for the entire people of the state of Alaska. However, that that'll be defined, and there'll probably be lively discussion as to how we define that. With that, let's take a 5-minute recess and try to keep it to a minimum of 10 minutes. Order. Mr. Clark.
Mr. Chairman, Jim Clark, Governor's Chief Negotiator on the gas pipeline and Chief of Staff. We are wanted to talk a little bit about the stranded gas amendment package that we have put before for you. And
is that a bill 3002?
That's correct.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I thought it'd be useful to discuss a little bit the strategy of this set of amendments that is before you. And you'll notice it's slimmed down significantly from the package we presented in the first special session. And I just wanted to, before I put Mr. Baldwin on the hot seat here, as to go through some of these items, it was just to explain the philosophy behind it. We have had an increasing discussion, Mr. Chairman, and I'd like to compliment you and the committee as a consequence of these committee hearings. We've had a lot of ideas generated and thoughts generated, both not only here in the committee, but in the public at large. And we knew we were planning over this break to go out and elicit more information from the public. We're going to be holding a kind of a feedback session in Juneau on Monday night, in the Kenai on Tuesday night, in Fairbanks on Wednesday night, Anchorage on Thursday night, and on Friday night in Eagle River and the Mat-Su. And the idea, and then Barrow on Monday the 24th. And the idea in each case is to set up a format whereby we'll explain to the public, as we'll explain to you this morning, some of the areas in which we're, we've heard the public, and not every one of those is necessarily going to mean a contract change. In some cases, it'll mean a better explanation or a change in policy that we'll express in the fiscal interest finding. But we thought it useful to work through that for the remainder of the week and until the public comment period closes on the 24th. And then when the committee comes back on the 24th, 25th, to come back and work with you to figure out what we might do collectively to come up with the amendments that would best meet the requirements of the legislature and of the people of the state. What we're particularly interested in doing, and we've asked people, the governor's asked people as we've as he's been addressing people, is let's get a list of the issues that are of concern. Let's see exactly what we can do to address those issues. Obviously, we need to address those issues in meetings with the producers with whom we, at this point, have negotiated a draft contract or a contract that we'll look at whatever amendments might be necessary. But we'd like to work through that process for the next 10 days and come back and work with you, Mr. Chairman, and the committee to formulate a more fulsome committee substitute that would reflect both what we're hearing, what you're hearing, and the will of the committee, as well as the thoughts of the administration. So that's the general philosophy behind the slimmed-down version of the package of amendments that is here. And I thought, Mr. Chairman, with your indulgence, it would be helpful if Mr. Baldwin could talk not only to the items that are in the CS, and we have Mr. Jeans here to testify on the school amendment that is in here, which we think is pretty important, but also to discuss some of the other areas of inquiry that we think that will flesh out those items on which we'll be working over this period, as I've described.
Mr. Baldwin.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jim Baldwin. I'm serving as outside counsel to the Office of the Attorney General. First, I'd like to just describe briefly for you what's in the bill before you, the Senate Bill 3002. This bill, basically in Section 1, contains an amendment to the Purpose Clause of the Stranded Gas Act to remove a provision that would have restricted our ability in an indirect way from proposing terms relating to the taxation of oil, and would we think counter the legislative history that was created back in 1998 when the act was originally created or enacted, which would which pointed the provisions of the fiscal contract only to terms relating to gas. Section 2 of the bill creates the fiscal structure to receive municipal impact funds, the $125 million in municipal impact funds. So it relates to how the money is received into the state treasury, how it's available for appropriation by the legislature when it's here. Sections 3, 4, and 5 will be very familiar to the committee. These bills were in the version that was passed out of this committee, really were amendments that were proposed, I believe, in this committee during this. The second special session of this legislature, and they basically were the product of recommendations received from the Municipal Advisory Group, and also the product of some prodding and urging from Senator Wilkin to provide for a grant process that was open and transparent and easily administered and understood by all who were involved. So that is contained in Section 3 of the bill. Section 4 of the bill extends the life of the MAG group, which has served a useful purpose in handling our relations with the affected municipalities. And Section 5 provides a remedy for a problem encountered in the way that property tax is full and true value for purposes of the foundation formula is calculated. That's in Section 5 of the bill. That was also a section that was adopted in this special committee during the second regular session. Going beyond that, I think we've been clear in, first of all, the fiscal interest finding, and then the testimony and the bill that we presented to this committee and other committees in the legislature during the second special session, that we believe we need conforming amendments to the Stranded Gas Act in order to have our contract provisions be consistent with the underlying law, the Enabling Act. So we're open to working with the committee to arriving at those amendments so that at the end of the day, when the commissioner makes his final fiscal interest finding, that he can make the finding that's required by law that the contract promotes the underlying purposes of the statute. Those areas include some of the subject matter that the committee saw in the version we introduced during the last special session, relating to the interaction of the contract with other agreements that are in effect by law, oil and gas leases, royalty settlement agreements, and agreements of that nature regarding various costs and charges for handling and treatment of the oil and gas. The provisions which authorize payments of tax in kind, and provisions which deal with the state's ability to take an equity interest in the project. We would also be interested in discussing with the committee a broad authorization to enter into other terms and provisions which are in the best interest of the state, to cover the various miscellaneous type of provisions that are in the contract, which we believe need to be covered by additional statutory authority. Beyond that, I'm available for questions if it's the will of the committee.
Questions from the members? Seeing none, we have then the intent is for us to hold this bill over, resume work on it after we come back on the 24th. And imagine that there are some features of this that, for an example, I heard the governor address in his speech to the combined group, the additional or the certainty issue that we did discuss in this committee in the last special session, which probably will resurface again. You're looking for some of those things to come as suggestions and amendments brought by the members of the committee, Mr. Clark?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. We also, as you correctly point out, the governor mentioned that yesterday. His speech is something that he felt needed to be addressed. But we still, as we do these things from where I'm sitting, we're working with the legislature, working with the producers, the public,
right,
and the governor. And so we are kind of caught in the as the spoke of a wheel, or the hub of a wheel, and we need to pull various other pieces together. We're going to be working during the course of the next week, not only to talk to the public about these things, but also with the producers, and to try to come back to you with ideas on how this might be fashioned in a way consistent with what the committee has already done. So we thought the committee thought that through well and did good work on it. We'll see if we can add anything to what you had produced to make those suggestions for your consideration.
And I do believe an issue that we will probably discuss is having to do with project labor agreements.
That was another point that the governor raised in his speech, as you'll recall, and it's an issue, again, with which we'll be talking with our colleagues in putting this contract together. As you know, our two important points about that. Number one, the fiscal agreement with the producers is really not the right spot for a project labor agreement. We're really talking about a situation that this contract does not reflect the entity which will be entering that agreement. It will be the LLC, and then the appropriate entity to make that those negotiations will be the contractor to the LLC. And there's a lot of issues involving a project labor agreement. In other words, we want to make sure all Alaskans are included, and that will all bear on the scope of such an agreement. But the governor would like to see that there is some direction on that. And again, we'll work with the committee to propose some ideas on how we might address that.
Mm-hmm. I don't believe, my sense is that the Alaska Hire, Alaska Purchase provisions that are in that Stranded Gas Act are very important to members of the legislature, and I understand also of the governor. So you won't have any objection if we expand the title on this bill a little bit?
Well, that's exactly what I'm offering, is that we work with the committee, work through the committee, and kind of amalgamate what you're hearing, what we're hearing, and put together a piece of legislation that will work.
All right. Comments from members? Senator Wilken?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple things, Mr. Clark. I'm sure you have Mr. Gildon's memo of July 13th with his initial reaction to 3002. And that may be a place to start in a week or so to perhaps reconcile his memo to the intent of 3002, and I'm sure you're going to do that. The other thing is, when we met back in a month ago, extended discussions at the table, and we continually, if not hourly, certainly almost that frequently, continue to run into the questions and the answers came back, well, the LLC will take care of that. But to date, we haven't seen the LLCs, the entity agreement. So could you help us? I don't think those questions are going to go away. So could you help us as to when we may see those so that we have some comfort in how we're going to run this thing?
Yeah, from the administration's point of view, the LLC is long overdue. We think that the LLC is an item that the committee should have. It certainly addresses a lot of Mr. Gildon's questions, addresses some of the access issues, and I think that the conversation you and I are hearing, which are being overheard by my colleagues in back of me, will be duly reported, and I intend to have a conversation with them today about the very same thing. We need to get
the LLC completed. There are some issues that are being discussed among the producers themselves, and they've run out of time. They need to get them resolved, and we need to be able to bring that before the committee and show how it interacts with the contract. That's just got to happen now. So, Senator, I completely agree with the point you're making.
Well, and Mr. Carr, thank you for that. And I'll just offer as a foot stomp that the people that are helping me on this issue, personal friends, have great concern that we have not seen the entity agreements. And it's a showstopper. So whatever we can do to work through those things, I encourage you and others to do that. Because I'm not sure the contract can proceed without at least some sort of a broad template that we have some comfort on how we're going to run this and what rights, responsibilities, and privileges we have as 20% owners. So thank you.
Ms. Clark, there's one other issue that I would like to address sometime as we get into this bill and into the Stranded Gas Development Act and into the contract that I anticipate you're going to be asking us to look at. That is a question that was brought up in Fairbanks in a legislative hearing down there, or up there, I should say, with one of our local attorneys who was very concerned about one question dealing with the integration clause in the contract. And interestingly enough, this is a contract which requires legislative approval in order for the administration to execute it. His reading of the integration clause in the contract is that once it is executed, upon agreement of all the parties, it can be amended without having any kind of legislative approval. The concern that he stated was, well, you guys will go through with a fine-tooth comb, you'll come out in the end, you'll approve a contract that meets the legislative intent, and then the administration has free rein to be able to amend the contract by the agreement of the parties. I would be very interested in your comments regarding the implications of the integration clause and how you might want to address that.
I think, Mr. Chairman, I told you at the time that please pass back to your friend that we're not that clever, but we will go back and make sure that there's some clarity to that. As a general philosophic approach, I think that as an administrative matter, an executory matter, there are things in this contract that executive body ought to be able to change. There's a lot of key functions, however, like tax rates and other things that should not be changed by the executive branch, should be changed only with the approval of the legislature. And we are, as I mentioned to you, we would going through and sorting out and making a proposal to you. That's kind of the type of thing that we're going to be doing as our homework over the course of this next week before we sit down to work out with the committee, some kind of committee substitute that's more fulsome than that which we presented today. But that issue needs to be addressed.
Thank you. Other questions, comments from members? Seeing none, we will look forward to resuming this committee at about 1:30 on Monday afternoon, the 24th of July. And is there any other matter to come before the committee today? Brief at ease. We'll take a brief at ease. Any other matters to come before the committee? Senator Wilkin.
Thank you. I happened to pop into my head looking at Mr. Griffin over there, and I meant to ask earlier, are we expecting an update on the Lucan study, and for my purposes, for forecasting gas prices and two capacity management issues?
Yes, we are, and I don't have an update to present to you right now.
Any time frame at all?
I honestly haven't checked on it in the last few weeks. I will do so today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Any other matters? Seeing none, we are adjourned, and we will resume on 1:30, the 24th of July.